Welcome to the Republican Professor. I'm your host, Dr. Lucas J. Mather. It's a wonderful spring day, and I'm not giving you an April Fool's, even though it's April 1st, 2025. It's a wonderful spring day here in Democrat land, Southern California. The tide is turning in Southern California, and I'm hoping that it continues in the correct direction. We are hitting Loper Bright. Again, Kagan dissenting. Of course, you know how to get there. Go to Google Scholar, case law, federal court, Loper, right? Well, actually, you know what? I think we did hold up, Yahada, Yahada. I think what we did was we did the slip opinion. Oh, did we do the slip opinion? I don't know. Loper, Bright, Enterprises. Let's see here. No. I did it on Google Scholar. I also did the slip opinion. Hold up. Yeah, hold up. Doing the slip opinion. Loper Bright. Hold up. Yeah, hold up. Right. Let's see if I got the slip opinion here. Yeah, I think I've already pulled it up. Okay. I'm sharing my screen. Feel free to call me, and you know the drill. Sharon. This is the slip opinion. You could just search Supreme Court Loper Bright. I just searched Loper Bright and it comes up. It's a slip opinion. I've gone over what a slip opinion is before. This is before it's bound in a volume and it tells you how to cite it as 603 US blank. And it says blank because they don't know what the page number will be until they actually publish it in the book. Now, if you go to Google Scholar, this will show the Supreme Court reporter. It's 144 Supreme Court at 2244, 2024. And that's a little bit different than the obviously the US reports, which is it's going to be in the 603rd edition of the US reports. All right. We are in Kagan. Yeah. Kagan's dissent. I like to do a search on dissenting. It's probably, I don't know, eight down or something like that. Yeah, maybe a little bit longer. There it is. Okay. Now, I'm reading the slip opinion because I printed out the slip opinion. So I'm going to try to, maybe I should just shine the slip opinion. I'll shiny wine the slip opinion. What page am I on? I'm on page 3, page 4 of Kagan dissenting. So I'm just going to scroll down. Till I see Kagan dissenting. The dissents are going to be after the concurrences. So here's Gorsuch concurring. You want to scroll down. Keep scrolling till you see some dissenting. Okay. All right, here we go. Kagan dissenting, page 2, page 3, and page 4. This is where we're at. I'm going to. Zoom in. We finished up to Roman numeral 1. Begin with the problem that gave rise to Chevron and also to its older precursors. The regulatory statutes Congress passes often contain ambiguities and gaps. Let's pause right there. Congress is the constitutionally empowered law-making authority. Let's just reflect on that. And I know you're thinking, oh my gosh, here he goes again. Article 1, of the US Constitution. He's pulling it up again. Well, yeah, I am. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. All right, just keep that in mind. There's ambiguities and gaps, she's saying. Okay, well, when you say that there's a gap, what exactly is the law then? Let's use a metaphor of crossing a creek. I recently crossed a creek on what used to be my wife's granddaddy's home on their ancestral farmland. And there's a creek that goes in the back of what used to be his house. Somebody else lives there now. Uncle Tommy used to live next door. Aunt Carol lives down the street. Cousin Chad lives across the street. Uncle Jack used to live in that house. I think he still owns that. They still own the barns. I'm trying to get over to the barn. I was actually on this other guy's property that used to be granddaddy's property. Well, actually, I don't know where the property line is, but anyway, no, actually, it was granddaddy's property. It's still in the family because there was a barn on one side, and I was looking for an owl, and I found an owl, and it was in there. So then I was crossing this creek, and it was quite steep, and I don't know, it was probably 10. You could stand right on the bank of the creek, and then nobody could see you from the road, just 100 yards out because it's so deep. It's like 10 feet in there. And so I was dressed in, I think, Sunday kind of clothes. I think we were at church or something earlier that day, and at Antioch Baptist Church in Humboldt, Tennessee. And I jumped across the creek. My point is that there was a gap, right? There was a gap. But in the gap in land, the land is still yours, right? I mean, it might be riparian, it might be a bank that changes contours. So it's a riparian rights kind of a deal where who owns the bank or who owns the land underneath the creek, you know. But let's assume the riparian rights are not at issue here, and that land is owned entirely, including the water and the it's not a navigable stream, and the land underneath it. Well, that is different than a gap in legislation, because a gap in legislation, I don't know how else to say it. There's no gap. I don't know what you're talking about. The law is the law, and if there's a blank space there in the middle, it's not the law. There's nothing there. There is no law there. If Congress leaves quote unquote gaps, then it's just not law there. There's no law there. And when you have an ambiguity, I mean, if law cannot be ambiguous, then there's no law there. Sometimes they are intentional. Perhaps Congress consciously desired. Hold on. Since when is the desire of Congress the law? As if you can measure that apart from the text. Perhaps Congress consciously desired the administering agency to fill in aspects of the legislative scheme. Well, hold on a second. How does that get all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress, not in an administrative agency? Believing that regulatory experts would be in a better position than legislators to do so. Well, hold on a second. The lawmaking power granted by the Constitution does not hinge on expertise. That's not a qualification to be a member of Congress, is that you're an expert in something. It doesn't say all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress just so long as there's a bunch of experts in there. That's not what it says. In fact, it seems to imply the opposite of that, because it says it shall be vested in a Congress which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. The House of Representatives represent people. Am I crazy here? And people are not experts. How could you be represented if it had to be expertise that was the qualifying factor for legislation? All right. So already there's all sorts of problems constitutionally here. We're in Roman numeral one, and I've barely gotten two sentences here. This is Kagan dissenting in Loper Bright, 2024. We're on page four, the bottom of the slip opinion. It's going to be in 603 of the U.S. reports. We don't know what page yet. Chevron. Okay. Or perhaps Congress was unable to forge a coalition on either side of a question. That's another way of saying there's no law there. And contending. See, she really wants there to be law there. She really, because she likes this. She wants, this is her policy preference. The parties decided to take their chances with the agency's resolution. Sometimes, though, the gaps or ambiguities are what might be thought of as predictable accidents. They may be the result of sloppy drafting and a non-infrequent legislative occurrence, or they may arise from the well-known limits of language or foresight accord. All right. Well. The subject matter of a statutory provision may, let me scroll down here so you can keep up. The subject matter of a statutory provision may be too specialized and varying to capture in its every detail, or the provision may give rise, years or decades down the road, to an issue the enacting Congress could not have anticipated. Switch to this side. So you can see this side of my tie. I've got a yellow tie on for the Easter season. Whichever the case, whatever, oh my gosh, whatever the issue, whatever the case, whatever the reason, the result is to create uncertainty about some aspect of a provision's meaning. We're on page five. Consider a few examples from the case law. They will help show what a typical Chevron question looks like, or really what a typical Chevron question is. Because when choosing whether to send some class of questions mainly to a court or mainly to an agency, abstract analysis can only go so far. Indeed, it may obscure what matters most. So I begin with the concrete. Here's her first bullet point. Okay. Now she's. A lot seems to be riding on these bullet points, guys. Oh yeah. I got some pens in my pocket. Thanks for pointing this out. A lot is riding on these bullet points. Here's the first one. Under a Public Health Service Act, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, regulates biological products, including proteins? When does an alpha amino acid polymer qualify as such a protein? Must it have a specific defined sequence of amino acids? Here's the second bullet point. Under the Endangered Species Act, the Fish and Wildlife Service must designate endangered vertebrate fish or wildlife species, including distinct population segments of those species. What makes one population segment distinct from another? Must the service treat the Washington state population of western gray squirrels as distinct? Go to the next page, page six. Because it is geographically separated from other western gray squirrels? Or can the service take into account that the genetic makeup of the Washington population does not differ markedly from the rest? Here's the third bullet point. Under the Medicare program, reimbursements to hospitals are adjusted to reflect differences in hospital wage levels across geographic areas. How should the Department of Health and Human Services measure a geographic area? By city, by county, by metropolitan area? Here's the next one. Congress directed the Department of Interior and the Federal Aviation Administration to reduce noise from aircraft flying over Grand Canyon National Park, specifically to provide for substantial restoration of the natural quiet. How much noise is consistent with the natural quiet, and how much of the park, or for how many hours a day, must that quiet? Must be that quiet for the substantial restoration requirement to be met. Here's another one. Or take Chevron itself. In amendments to the Clean Air Act, Congress told states to require permits for modifying or constructing stationary sources of air pollution. Does the term stationary source refer to each polluting emittent piece or equipment within a plant, or does it refer to the entire plant and thus allow escape from the permitting requirement when increased emissions from one piece of equipment are offset by reductions from another? Okay. In each case, I'm on page seven of the Kagan dissent, which goes to, let's see how far we got to go. Not today, but just total. The Kagan dissent goes to, well, this goes past page 19, so we're obviously not going to go that far today. I'm on page seven. In each case, a statutory phrase has more than one reasonable meaning, and Congress has not chosen among them. All right, let's just stop right there, guys. That's kind of the problem, isn't it? Congress has not chosen. Who the hell is making laws around here? I mean, she thinks this is some kind of problem. This is not a problem. It is just the reality. If Congress has not legislated here, it hasn't legislated. There is no law. And she thinks that's a reductio ad absurdum. It's not. It's a reductio ad realitium, to coin a phrase. Reality is not absurd. If reality was absurd, and follow this here, if reality was absurd, a reductio ad absurdum argument form would not work. the whole point of a reductio ad absurdum form of argument assumes that reality itself is not absurd. So that if you, your premises and assumptions together with correct rules of inference, whether inductive, deductive, or abductive, imply, given according to whatever shape of the argument, deductive, inductive, or abductive, imply with the requisite strength an absurd result, then that cannot be reality. And so you're permitted thereby to go, in fact, required to go back and find where the problem was in the premises and the assumptions. That's the whole point of a reductio ad absurdum argument. But she seems to be unaware that this is not a reduction to absurdity. This is just reality. Congress has not chosen. That means there is no law. Okay? There's no law about this. Western squir gray squirrels, whatever. I mean, what's the law? There is no law. Congress can't figure that out, then Congress shouldn't be legislating about it. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. Okay, let's keep going. Congress has not chosen among them. It has not, in any real word sense, world sense, fixed the single best meaning at the time of enactment. Okay, well, then there's no law there. If there's nothing there for the judge to interpret and say what the law is, then there's no law there. And Congress has to do a better job. Maybe Congress doesn't have the competence to be making all these damn freaking laws that it wants to make damn freaking laws about. I think that's actually what you're saying, is that there shouldn't be laws about this. If it's too hard, then there can't be laws about this. We've already decided as the American ethnicity, we've done the balancing test at the founding, at the framing, that all legislative powers shall be vested in a Congress. That's already been decided. It reminds me of these people that want to reinvent the Second Amendment. They're like, I know it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, but let's infringe it. No, it's already been decided. It's already been decided at this, at the framing of the Constitution and the ratification. Unless you just don't believe in constitutionalism, which maybe that's really what's going on here. You think you can reinvent a constitution every time it gives you a result that you don't like? Well, then maybe you should just move to England, have a parliament. That's not what we have here. We have a written constitution. And Congress has not chosen among them. It has not, in any real world sense, fixed the single best meaning at the time of enactment. A question thus arises: who decides which of the possible readings should govern? It's amazing. It's amazing. I think we should stop her paycheck. Like, Congress should just be like, okay. Yeah. I mean, if Congress was a guy, I would just stop the paycheck right now. I'd be like, okay, who decides? Well, let's read the Constitution again. Let's see here. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress. I think you just said Congress decides if you read the Constitution. If you read case law, the Supreme Court decides. But if you read the Constitution, Congress decides. By the way, are we reading the Constitution in law school? Is that just an appendix? Is it one of those appendices that gets taken out when it gets infected? You know, just like in humans, we're not sure what it does, why it's there. I think a lot of people treat the Constitution exactly that way, and they think that just judges should decide this stuff. Ironically, given what she's saying, this court has long thought that the choice should usually fall to the agencies, which courts broadly deferring to their judgments, with courts broadly deferring to their judgments. For the last 40 years, that doctrine has gone by the name of Chevron, Chevron deference. Yeah, lowrider. After the 1984 decision that formalized and canonized it. In Chevron, the court set out a simple two-part framework for reviewing an agency's interpretation of a statute that it administers. First, the reviewing court must determine whether Congress has directly spoken to the precise issue question at issue. That inquiry is rigorous. A court must exhaust all the traditional tools of statutory construction. To divine statutory meaning. And when it can find that a mean that meaning a single right answer, that is the end of the matter. The court cannot defer because it must give effect to the unambiguously expressed intent of Congress. But if the court, after using its whole legal toolkit, concludes that the statute is silent or ambiguous with respect to the specific issue in dispute, for any of the not uncommon reasons discussed above, then the court must cede the primary interpretive role. Excuse me. Where is that in the Constitution? Excuse me. I know that's in the Supreme Court decision, but I'm asking where is it in the Constitution? That at that second step, the court asks only whether the agency construction is within the sphere of reasonable readings. Let me ask you this. Reasonable readings. What makes a court expert at that? What makes a court or a judge expert in what is reasonable? Just throwing that question out there. Serious question. What makes a court expert at that? Do you have a class in law school of what, you know, how to be reasonable? Introduction to reasonable readings, and then mid-level and then advanced skills in being reasonable. No. In fact, you're not even allowed, you're not even taking logic in law school or to get into law school. You're not even required to take that. And I would say you're not even allowed to take it for credit. At the second step, the court asks only whether the agency construction is within the sphere of reasonable readings. If it is, the agency's interpretation of the statute that it every day implements will control. So, what she just said was Congress doesn't affect a legislative answer. So, then what some judge thinks is reasonable then now controls as long as it was said by the executive branch. So, it's the executive branch under under this reasonability test that controls what law is, not what Congress says the law is. It's what a judge says that the executive branch, what they did, is reasonable or not. So, under this way of looking at it, who's making the law? The judge, by deferring constantly to the agency as long as they're not contradicting themselves? Or is it the agency that's just doing whatever the hell they want as long as they're not contradicting themselves? If it is, the agency's interpretation that it every day implements will control. That rule, the court has long explained, rests on a presumption about legislative intent, about what Congress wants when a statute it has charged an agency with implementing contains an ambiguity or a gap. I'm on page 8. An enacting Congress, as noted above, knows those uncertainties will arise, even if it does not know what they will turn out to be. And every once in a while, Congress provides an explicit instruction for dealing with that contingency, assigning primary responsibility to the courts or else to an agency. But much more often, Congress does not say. Thus arises the need for a presumption, really a default rule, for what should happen in that event. Does a statute silence or ambiguity then go to a court for resolution or to an agency? This court has long thought Congress would choose an agency, with courts serving only as a backstop to make sure the agency makes a reasonable choice among the possible readings. Here's my question: why not have the public make this rule? Have this role. Or said otherwise, Congress would select the agency it has put in control of a regulatory scheme to exercise the degree of discretion that a statute's lack of clarity or completeness allows. Of course, Congress can always refute that presumptive choice, can say that really it would prefer courts to wield that discretionary power. But until then, the presumption cuts in the agency's favor. Says who? Says the court. The next question is why? Let's take a look at this footnote. Note that the presumptions of this kind are common in law. In other contexts, too, the court responds to a congressional lack of direction by adopting a presumption about what Congress wants, rather than try to figure that out in every case. And then Congress can legislate with predictable effects against that stable background rule. Take the presumption against extraterritoriality. The court assumes Congress means for its statutes to apply only within the United States, absent a clear indication to the contrary. Or the presumption against retroactivity. The court assumes Congress wants its laws to apply only prospectively unless it unambiguously instructs something different. Or the presumption against the repeal of statutes by implication. The court assumes Congress does not intend a later statute to displace an earlier one unless it makes that intention clear and manifest. Or the so far unnamed presumption against the treating of a procedure requirement as jurisdictional unless Congress clearly states that it is. I could continue, except that this footnote is long enough. The Chevron deference rule is to the same effect. The court generally assumes that Congress intends to confer discretion on agencies to handle statutory ambiguities or gaps, absent a direction to the contrary. The majority calls that presumption a fiction, but it is no more so than any of the presumptions listed above. They are all best guesses and usually quite good guesses. by courts about congressional intent. All right, I this bled onto page 9 at the bottom, and so I want to go back up to the top of page 9. Let's try to figure out how far we want to go here. Okay, I think we're going to stop there today. So we're stopping at the top of page 9 of the Kagan dissent, and we're going as fast as the material allows us to go. Thanks for joining me on the Republican Professor podcast. It is the 1st of April 2024, years, wow, 2025, years after Jesus. Happy Easter season to you. We'll talk to you next time.